everyone, it's Sparky here. Thanks so much for joining today. I have a very special guest. His name is Jonah Miller. And Jonah is a very talented, skilled canine behaviorist that works down in Toronto, Ontario. And he specializes in complex behavior cases. So this means when your dog has more than one problem, and you've tried to solve it, you might have had multiple professionals in, but nobody's really been able to crack the case. That's when you want to call Jonah. So today we're going to talk about Jonah's experience with me, because I was honored and was Jonah's guide and teacher on the CNSS method, which is Canine Neurobiological System Science. And we apply it to dog behavior cases when the dog is going through what we call persistent behavior. And we adapt and create a unified family around for you and for your dog to ensure that the behavior is managed and that you build a relationship and that you really enjoy your dog. We're going to talk today about a really great case. It's a case that is very near and dear to both of our hearts, and that is Kodak. So I'm very pleased to welcome Jonah. I'm going to stop talking now, and let's get into the episode. Back to the Dog Parentology Podcast. Today we're doing something special, sharing a case that stayed with both of us. It's a story of Kodak, a young Labrador with 2 years of mounting behavioral issues, nothing resolved, and caregivers nearing the edge. Aggressive, barking at other dogs, demand barking, jumping, leash chaos, overstimulation, all of it. But this isn't a story about behavior being bad. It's a case about what happens when you stop managing symptoms and start looking at the system that behavior belongs to. I'm joined by Jonah, a practitioner I trained early on. Jonah now works with complex cases himself, and we've done dozens of cases side by side. This one, Kodak, was pivotal. Jonah, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
I want to go back to the very beginning. That intake form came in and it was loaded with complaints, right? Barking, leashing, pulling, overstimulation, jumping on guests. But that's not what we listened for. We started looking at sleep quality, the household tone, the caregiver's mental fatigue, and the schedule tension, the signals underneath the barking. And that's what I teach. Behavior is an output, with the input is the system. So, Jonah, you were in that first session with me. What did you notice walking into that home?
It was hectic. Everybody was really on edge. Koda was, this is after the big incident that they'd had. And there was just a general, I guess, fear in the house as to what he might do. And there was also a lot of demand barking.
Tell us a little bit about that incident, Jonah.
Essentially, he was a COVID pup. Spent the first, I think, 6 months at home, never hardly leaving the house with his entire family there. Routinely, they would go out once a day to play fetch with a soccer ball. After about 6 months of that, I guess things were opening back up, and Dad, who the father, went back to work, and those games stopped. We started working them about a year. It was about a year and a half when we started, so it was a good year after that. And I guess for about a year, he hadn't played soccer or fetch at all, seen a soccer ball, or had any of that interaction. A year later, Mom is walking him down the road. He sees a kid play with a soccer ball and just completely loses it. Drags her, gets away from her, bites the ball, won't give the ball to anybody, ended up half ingesting the ball before they could even get it away from him. Created a whole situation. They'd gone through several trainers that couldn't really figure out how to desensitize him to that. And then the final thing was just to keep him away from balls, from especially soccer balls altogether, which I just didn't see as feasible in any way. They lived across the street from a school. every day after school. There's kids playing with balls up in there. It's virtually impossible for him to never see one.
So that brings me to my next question. I want to fast forward to that early shift moment, the one we didn't plan. We were working on trying to establish a safe routine for Kodak when his caregiver had to work from home. And then something changed, not because of technique, but because she stopped trying to fix it. Talk a little bit about that and walk us through what you saw in Kodak during that pause and the moment she changed and he changed.
So there was two pivotal moments there. The first one was when we got in the house and we sat down. At first, everybody was standing up and they were trying to have a conversation. He was the man barking like crazy. So it was just barking away. And we had them sit down, invited him up next to us and did some calming like yoga breaths. And she sat down, the mom sat down. And within, I would say 2 minutes, you saw a completely different dog. Just that calming, yeah. Just sitting down on the couch rather than standing around, four adults standing around a small living room. Sitting down, taking a deep breath, letting it out your nose, and really relaxing. And as we all sat down and did that, he just sat down, curled on the couch next to mom, and he would have fallen asleep within a few minutes. The way you know, he was so calm after a few minutes. It was a real eye-opening moment, yeah.
That moment of co-regulation, that moment of softening those emotional indicators from the caregiver, what a powerful moment that was for them, right?
Definitely. And I think that's when they saw that he can be different. And it's all about how you act around him and the situation, the environment that you're creating.
And that's interesting because what we were watching isn't a moment of disobedience. It had nothing to do with obedience. It was the nervous system reorganizing itself, a small window into that white pathway when the dog pauses, not from fear or control, but there's an uncertainty and then they relax into that space. That's what I hear as you describe it to help understand that moment and what does it mean. So tell me a little bit about the ball scenario. What were some of the things that you needed to look at in order to come up with the solution?
I honestly, you were amazing on that. They'd been through so many trainers and everybody had kind of been at their wit's end and gone, we can't be around balls. And I was starting to think about propping balls and maybe we can have him watch and kind of get used to not going after the ball. And
yeah, desensitization and counter conditioning, yeah.
Yeah, but even the idea, how would you do that with him being that obsessed with, like as soon as he sees one, he's just going to, you know, so it has to be at a huge distance. And the whole thing was very complicated. And then you came up with something that mainly because he was ingesting. He'd already been to the vet a couple of times for eating entire soccer balls that he just wouldn't give up. I knew that he needed to have a lot of soccer balls around, but I just didn't, I wasn't computing how that could work. And then he came with the ones from the internet that we found that he couldn't ingest.
Right, those were the herding balls, very tough balls. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And we bought, I think, like a dozen or 15 or I don't know, like they had the whole house just littered with these balls all over the place. And he went nuts when he first saw them. But by the end of the hour, you know, he started calming down. And after a week, there was almost no sensitivity to balls anymore.
And that's interesting because from a resource guarding perspective and the brain from a neurobiological perspective is just the limbic system is alive. It's what I call Tom. And Tom is calling out the alert that there is something precious that will be taken away and as it had been done. And that loss was something that was very, very threatening to the dog in ways that we don't understand, nor do we need to understand. It's simply that neurobiological system coming into place. And when we see something like that occurring, we know that we have to establish, first of all, how do we rewire the brain to realize that the threat doesn't exist? And we have to do that in sensory ways. And one of the things that you've talked about when you're reflecting on Kodak was his, you know, the mouth feel because he ate it, like the taste of it, the ingestion of it, the love of it, the touching of it. And what shifted was the visual cues. So sensory processing, if we shift it from the key triggers into something that is a sensory process that is tied to a positive experience, we can then shift the dog quite dramatically. And so where the sensory processing came into place here is we used visualization. So, and not in the sense that we do as human beings where we say, you know, well, visualize success. No, this is in visualizing and seeing the actual practical scene of all these balls everywhere, which then challenged that belief system within the dog, right?
Yeah, exactly. It was amazing and very eye-opening.
One of the most powerful things in Kodak's case was the caregiver's willingness to self-reflect. She came in exhausted, but she was curious. And when she started tracking her tone, her pacing, her responses, we saw Kodak change too. Even from that early moment, as she continued through the case working with us. That's what the canine neurobiological system science teaches. The system includes you. The dog doesn't behave in a vacuum. And so, Jonah, what did you notice in the caregiver's change that made the biggest impact on Coda? And if you could talk a little bit about the posture and the co-regulation, the way that she helped the dog relax.
Yeah. They were actually some of my favorite people to work with. They were so good. They really got it right away, and they just changed the way that they behaved. A lot of times people nod their head, but I believe that in the moment they don't actually change that much, or it's just hard to change your habits. With them, they really did. They took it to heart, and after the first session, after we explained it, she changed her body language. She changed her entire behavior around the dog. Like, a lot of what was happening is that she, after being dragged and losing control of him in that whole incident, was extremely nervous walking him. And he was feeding off that energy. So she was going out nervous. As soon as she got out, opened the door, yanked the leash. Like, come here, don't run away from me, right? And that puts him on edge as soon as you step outside. And it just escalates from there. She wasn't taking treats. The whole thing was just fraught with anxiety. And once I explained that to her, and she really started relaxing, and he was a great dog. He didn't even really need a leash. Like, he would stay right next to you. He was a wonderful dog to work with. As they changed their behavior there, and yeah, a lot of co-regulation. She really took the yoga breathing and the calming down to heart. I remember on walks when she'd get nervous, I'd be like, okay, well, let's sit down. Let's calm down, take a deep breath, calm him down, and we'll start walking again. And that was a big change.
Yeah. And that's something that we did over and over again. And I remember you being quite surprised at how we sort of embraced the caregiver in every single case, because the dog wasn't going to change overnight. We had to embrace them and encourage them. And we really took the caregiver as part of the system. If we were going to make something that was long-term and we were going to be with them for life, then we really needed to reach in and embrace the caregiver for all their flaws, for all their strengths, and try to tailor the program to empower them. And I remember you being very surprised about that.
Yeah. That was one of the most eye-opening things that I'd seen us do. Really changed my attitude about how to work with dogs, because it made such a huge difference. And them being so receptive and so helpful, to be honest, made a big difference, because they were so cooperative. Sometimes it's like, the dog doesn't change overnight, but the change can be significantly faster if we're all working together on the same page. And we actually follow through on things every single time. That consistency is key, and they really were great like that.
They were really good partners, and that's the way that we shifted things. They weren't hiring us. And remember how many times I said that, right? You're not hiring us, we are partners. And if you're at the table, we'll be at the table, right? And that was all about it.
And they really came to the table. Yeah. That was an amazing thing with them.
By the time Kodak was nearing graduation, we weren't focused on problem solving. We were building resilience. He was sleeping more deeply. He was checking in rather than barking. He paused when startled. And he was, for the first time, choosing not to react. Now, Jonah, you witnessed this firsthand. So if you could describe Kodak in one word, I know that's going to be tough. You can use more than one if you want. At the end of the work, what would it be?
In one word, I guess I would say eager.
Yeah.
He was very eager to get the ball. He was very eager for attention, but he was also eager to please. And as soon as he understood how to work with the family and be a part of this and work together, he just went right for it. It was
beautiful.
It was amazing to see how much yes, the ball is exciting to me, or the dog across the street, but this is what we're doing, and I would prefer to be with you. Seeing that choice, that act of choosing is just amazing.
And okay, so now I'm going to switch it around. What would you say about the caregiver? What would be that one word at the end of it that you saw in the caregivers? What would be that one word that you describe them?
I guess cooperative. They really learned to work together.
That's wonderful.
They would pay attention to his body language. They learned his cues. I mean, they already kind of knew his cues, but they were scared of them.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
If the ears went up, she would just be like, what do I do?
What's going on? Right.
Exactly. So instead of getting scared or worried about it, they knew what to do when they saw those signs, and they very quickly learned how to prevent the behaviors from occurring. And from that, it goes into this wonderful, getting along and, you're such a good dog because you're always listening to me and I'm so happy with you. And then the dog is feeding off that energy rather than the anxiety. And next thing you know, everybody's just blissful.
Yes, exactly. One of the things that I remember that was so cool was that, and we saw this so many times, Jonah, in who would be successful in our program. And that was her consistency in putting in daily journals, in tracking those things like sleep and the events so that we could actually see what was going on as we were adapting and changing that system. Behavior doesn't change unless you fix the system. The system was quite complex around this dog and what was influencing it. It wasn't just balls. It was the schedule, suddenly having somebody there and then suddenly not. It was a lot of anxiety, the inability to find that co-regulation that was needed with the person that he counted on the most. So when Joan and I ask, when a client comes to us and says, so what's the fix? We don't answer that. The question is, what system is your dog adapting to right now? Because if we don't change the system, we won't change the behavior.
Yeah, I think... probably the most important thing is that we change their entire lifestyle from the beginning of the program. And I think the big changing of the entire environment, the entire lifestyle, and a lot of times people have a hard time keeping the data or understanding why it's so important. But I think that was one of the best things that it was so joyful. You would sit down after a couple of weeks of the program and you look at the data and you can see sleep going up. You see self-soothing and self-play and all this stuff going way up, and all the behaviors the problem behaviors just decreasing. And yeah, and you could graph it. It's amazing. And when you graph it, you can show them what they've done. Like, you can visualize. The data is just so useful. I wish people would just keep better data, honestly, on their dogs, especially if you're medicating and going into a vet that's supposed to give your dog medication and has no data to work off of. You would never do that with a person.
No, never. Yeah. So, Jonah, now, if someone's listening and their dog behavior feels stuck, what would you want them to know?
Well, two things. One, there is a function to the behavior and we will find it and change it. But the overall is very important too.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's the dog will have a behavior like going after soccer balls or whatever, barking at other dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the dog is not getting enough exercise, not getting enough play, not getting enough... depending on what the behavior is, of course, but there's just when you change the overall and you change the amount of sleep that they're getting and the amount of meals that they're getting in the day, you break it up to more meals, watch the blood sugar levels, just pay attention to the overall of the dog and the entire system that the dog is living in. sometimes you get behavior changes, you don't even know why it happened exactly, but it's the overall change that just shifts just the entire relationship and the entire way that the dog behaves in the world. And by the end of the program, it's almost like a different dog.
And different people. That's what I find is the family unites, you know, in a way that they didn't even know was possible.
Definitely around the dog. They behave completely different around the dog, which makes the biggest difference.
And how many times have we heard that, right? Where they said the way that you shifted our views on the dog and how we approach the dog and what we think about the dog has and the deepened understanding of their emotional way of seeing the world. We heard that so often, didn't we? Yeah.
Yeah. I think one of the most common things is that very often people were just really set on, I need to walk the dog a certain amount of times. I need to get him out. Needs this a certain amount of exercise, I know that was a big thing. Dogs were probably under-exercised in the past, but not all dogs need, it's very individual. And sometimes the dog doesn't need that walk or doesn't want it. And it's very hard for people to compute that and just kind of scale it back and start fresh and see what the dog is actually wanting to do and not have your own preset idea of, oh, I have to go to work and I got 15 minutes to walk the dog right now. I need him to poo. So you need to get 1 kilometer that way, 1 kilometer that way, get back. We got 10 minutes to do it. And maybe the dog's just not into that right now.
It was, as I was reflecting, I thought about how many cases we had where we disengaged the whole walking concept, dogs walking.
No, very common.
They don't need to be walked. They need to be exercised and stimulated. Yes. And how it really is a classic lesson in the very basics of systems thinking is that it's called equifinality. A big $10 word for saying there's multiple ways to achieve the same outcome. And so when we stop and think that exercise and stimulation must be walking and maybe sniffing or walking and giving them a puzzle, it's like, well, no, it can be anything that resonates with your dog and that lands with the correct amount of exercise for your dog and the correct amount of stimulation for your dog, right? You brought that to my mind.
That pre-work morning walk could be very, very stressful on the dog sometimes. It's like you're in a rush. Everybody's walking their dogs at the same time. There's a lot of dogs out. There's a lot of barking. You have anxiety from the moment you get out the door. People are always in a rush. They forget to take the treats. It's just sometimes maybe it's better not to and do something else for those 15 minutes.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe play in the backyard.
And one of the things that we did for people is we made sure they had a very clear schedule. It was adaptive. Like they could make it whatever they wanted. But we showed them a sample of what that schedule would look like as they were embedding the program into their lives.
I think the routines are so important for dogs. They build so much of their understanding of what's happening in the world around the routine and knowing that, we go for a walk around this time, we come home, then we have our whatever ritual, and they build. And then I have my meal and I go to take a nap. If their day is regimented like that, they're just really happy. They don't look for spontaneity, you know? They're very happy just kind of mapping out their day and knowing how to go about it. Of course, they're always happy if you can surprise them with a nice walk or a good treat, but just knowing what's coming up and having that idea of like how the day progresses is huge. It's huge for dogs.
I want to thank Jonas so much for coming onto the show today. And don't worry, I did ask him if he could leave us some information on how to get in touch with him. Let's just show you that real quick.
Want some advice? Please feel free to reach out to me. My email is pivotalchangetoronto, all one word, pivotalchangetoronto@gmail.com. Please reach out. I'm always here. Thank you.
Hey, everybody, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Please remember to subscribe, hit that like button if you like this content, and we will be back with more great episodes coming up very soon. Thanks again to my guest, Jonah, and I hope you guys have a great day. Don't forget, be kind to your dog.